This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Let's begin today's talk in the traditional way with a case from our Zen or Chan history. For anyone who's not familiar with this, a lot of the teachings come from the Tang Dynasty Chan tradition in China, and they're called cases, koans, usually a little bit of a story. They're a conversation. Sometimes just a statement, usually very simple. And from this base, we can explore our talk today. Often these are a little bit difficult to understand, but we'll try and unfold it as we go. So this is from case number 74 from the Shoyuroku or the Book of Serenity, and it's Fayan's substance and name. There's a slight introduction, and here's the introduction. Plenty have myriad virtues swept clear. There's not a mote of dust detached from all forms, identical to all things, taking a step on top of a 100-foot pole. The universe in all direction is one's whole body. But tell me, where does it come from? That's a little introduction to the case from the commentator. So here's the case, here's the story. So once upon a time, in a land far, far away, but it's right here. A monk asked Fayan, "I hear that in the teachings there is a saying, from a non-abiding basis are established all things. What is the non-abiding basis?" Fayan said, "Form arises before substantiation. Names arise from before naming." Repeat that. His answer to the question, what is the non-abiding basis? What is this non-abiding basis? This reality that is beyond our formations and preconceptions. What's going on that is actual reality? So Fayan says, form arises before substantiation, names arise from before naming. So this is the case for today. I'm sure everybody completely understands that, right? No problem. No. Okay. You know, I haven't been in this teaching seat for over a year, so I'm just getting used to it again. The last time I talked, which I think was last summer sometime, I kind of talked on this same subject. It was about the function or the functioning of our practice. What's it about? We have this activity called meditation. This is the focus. That's what Zen means. It's the school of meditation. We have this focus, this activity of meditation, and in a strict sense, we can say it has no purpose. It has no direction. It just exists for itself. Just for itself. But we can also deliberately, and part of our practice, inquire about what we're doing. So traditionally in meditation, there's these, how it's described classically, there's these two aspects or two wings of meditation. You may have heard of these. There's shamatha, which is settling, placing, calmly abiding, being with, being in place, the activity of settling ourselves into the meditation process by being, having a sense of being located with our posture, or maybe attending a natural activity like the rhythm of our breath, being sensitive to that and being with that could be called the focus on shamatha practice. That's one wing of this bird. And the second wing of this bird is called vipassana. And vipassana is used for another kind of title for another tradition of practice from the Theravada path. It also means, to see precisely or to see clearly. That's vipassana. So these are the two wings of meditation. So this is what we do. This is our kind of format, you could say, for meditation. Shamatha and vipassana. They like the two wings of a bird, they should both be in, you could say, in flight. And they should both be in balance for the meditation to move forward, for the bird to move forward. That balance, that yukanada it's called, is that balance of shamatha and vipassana is our sort of practice way. Now, might be a little outside the understanding of normal Zen instruction, but I would say as a rule that in the beginning of practice, in the initiation of practice, not just even in the beginning of practice, if you've been practicing for a long time, as you begin to sit down, you begin with shamatha practice. You begin to calm, to pacify, to settle, to basically to arrive, you know? That's what you do in the beginning. And you follow your breath, you settle down, you notice, you allow your mind to be still and quiet as much as possible. As your practice develops, you could say, the potential for vipassana to arise or to become more you could say, more vibrant or more visible to you, although it's already functioning there, just in the fact that you're awake, you're mindful of your practice. The capacity for Vipassana to arise becomes more, probable, and or there's more potential for it there, because you've settled yourself, because you've calmed yourself, because you've arrived, you can actually see. So they say the Chinese characters for shamatha and vipassana, I don't have the correct pronunciation, but the actual characters, the kanji or the characters. Shamatha, the character for shamatha, also just means to stop. To stop. It's the same character, different connotation. To stop, and for vipassana, to see. So we stop, and then once we've stopped, we have the opportunity to see, actually, to see what's going on, to see ourselves, to see our minds, to see what's happening, basically, whatever's happening. It's kind of like, like maybe we got a busy life. We got a lot of things to do, got appointments. We're going from point A to point B. We're walking along, and this is meditation. In the midst of all this activity of being, of our own being, of making a self, whatever, of our life, we along on this path of walking along, being very busy, we decide to stop. We decide we're on the path, we stop, take some breaths, and what do? We look around, right? We might look around. We might look and see the world that's right there on the path in front of us. We might look and see where we're walking, or how our mind is, or what's, we might look inside. But so along the way, this is meditation. Along the way of our life, we stop and then we see. That's shamatha and vipassana. Those are the two wings of meditation. And the bird, when the wings are going well, the bird flies. And there's the vast sky of your life. What I'd like to do in the context of this case that we just read, and is focus a little bit more today on this vipassana quality, and actually on the kind of awareness or knowing of what's going on, what's going on of this seeing process. What do they call it? Anatarya Samadhi. Basically, you could simply say it's Anatarya Samadhi, Samadhi of immediacy, Samadhi of the present moment, the one pointedness of the present moment. I could say that's enough. But that's not our experience, is it? At least that's not my experience. When I sit down to meditate, I notice, maybe a few of you may notice too, the amazing creativity of my mind, the amazing capacity for production, for fabrication, for fashioning, for becoming, for making a world, for making a self, it's like Horvacui. I make a little space and things flood in. And I'm amazed at how productive and how creative that my internal life is. And I discover it when I sit down and I'm quiet. I actually have an insight into how creative my mind is only when I make space, only when I make the place for it to be visible. When I stop, then I can see. I can see my own mind. And what do I see? I see a creator. I see a fabricator. I see someone who is making a world, making it particularly, I'm making a self. And I'm making a self in relation to the world around me. Now, I don't know about you, but sometimes when I meditate and I see that kind of mind, I'm a little overwhelmed or exasperated, because I presume if I get into a kind of meditative state, it's all going to be kind of a bliss hit. I'm going to be calm and peaceful, and my mind is going to be still. Instead, what I discover is that my mind is productive, and it might be busy, it might even be flooded, it might be or it might alternately, it might be adversely contracted, which might manifest itself in dreaminess or sleepiness or spaciness, which is very common in meditation. That's a kind of way of avoiding the seeing or ignoring the seeing. They call this the phonological loop, the brain's this internal dialogue that we have. It's our brain's, they call it the brain's clearinghouse, this capacity we have to continuously talk to ourselves and maintain our world through an internal dialogue. What do we do when we sit down and we stop and we see, and that's what we see. We see a mind that fabricates, a mind that creates, a mind that is maintaining the world. What do we do? The most obvious answer might be to stop that fabricating, to push it away, to stop thought, to kind of excise thought from our consciousness during meditation. Have you tried to do that? It's not very successful, I would recommend, to try and push away thought, because our minds are, well, they just secrete thoughts. Our minds are thought secretors, you could say. Vipassana, precise seeing, is seeing what's going on, seeing what's around you. So you've stopped, and now you're going to see what's going on within you, and also with the outside of me. So what's going on? I am a fabricator. I am a fashioner. I am a creator of a self. I'm a creator of my world. I'm doing this. Okay, this is what's going on. I'm going to study this. I am going to look at this. I'm going to look at my own fabrication. I'm going to look at my own capacity to make a world. In other words, I'm going to be, this is Vipassana. I'm going to be kind of like a scientist. And my own mind is my laboratory. I'm going to study my fabrication. I'm going to study my creative capacity. And see what's going on. I'm going to look at it. And if I look at it and I see it clearly, that looking at it is practice. Yes, following your breath and being one-pointed by focusing on is practice as well. But actually moving from shamatha to vipassana and looking at the nature of your own mind is practice as well. You can, in the midst of practice, you can see your mental fabrication. You can see your creation. You can see your story. And you can see the one who makes the story. And you can even ask, why is this story being made? And you can study the, what's called the, classically, the origin factors and the dissolution factors of dharmas. Dharmas means phenomena, events, anything. The origin factors and the dissolution factors of dharmas. The origin factors and dissolution factors of this mental fabrication. Why is it arising? What's its cause? Why am I thinking this? Why am I spaced out? Why am I dreaming? You can study this in practice, still being with your breath, still being present, still being available in the present moment, not being too analytical in your practice. You can actually ask, what's here? When we ask that of ourselves, and we inquire, we might think that's not insight, but actually seeing the nature of your own mind, seeing the origin factors, that they have a cause, this fabrication has a cause, and it also is just for that time, it'll cease. You can study the origin factors and the dissolution factors of the dharma of your own mind as these thoughts arise. And that study or that inquiry or that seeing is can be part of your practice, and it can be insight. You know, you can awaken to the nature of your own mind. You don't have to awaken to a separate state, to a blissful state, to an alternate reality. You can awaken to your mind as it is right now. Where else would you go looking for? Where else? Yeah. Good luck finding it somewhere else. Yeah, it's difficult because sometimes this internal dialogue we have is kind of like a bully to us. It feels like it's bossing us around. It feels like it's kind of this internal chatter that we have is kind of owns us. And of course, we know we're not just our thoughts. You know? We're not just what we're thinking. And yet it feels like it's our boss. And it's easy for us to stay with thought or stay with conceptual nature. It's because in a certain sense, it's very familiar. It's like a boat being tied to the pier in a harbor. We're very safe. We know our thoughts. We know our story. We know it's very familiar to us. But to cut that line and to let the boat move out into the ocean, into this oceanic vastness of reality, and to see ourselves in this greater context, and to be unbound from this fabrication, is a little bit fearful, and it's not easy. And it takes, I would say, it takes some kind of courage. Actually release, let go of that samstava, that habitual pattern that of making a self. Bodhidharma, the teachings from Bodhidharma says there's two kinds of knowledge, two kinds of knowing. And this may sound a little simplistic, but this is how it's condensed in Bodhidharma's teachings. The first one is the regularity of dharmas. The regularity or the constancy or the reality, you could say, of all of phenomena, of our phenomenal world. And the second one is unbinding. It said that the arhats, the original arhats, the original disciples of the Buddha were known to be arhats because they were unbound. They were free. They were free. They were free from this pattern of fabrication, of construction. They were free. They were able to see the world unobscured by their own imagining. There's another way of looking at fabrication and of insight. We could also say that insight itself is a form of fabrication. It's a form of doing, of making. We could say that being deliberately being still and following your breath is a form of fabrication, of construction, or doing. So you can understand that these terms are ambiguous, and that the sense of fabrication is understood as, or the sense of construction, or the sense of making a self is pervasive. So, the teacher teacher that I like very much called Thanissaro Bhikkhu, a Theravada teacher who who has an essay on this. It's called Fabricating the Present. And he talks about, here's a little quote from what he says. We often think that Vipassana means, excuse me. We often think that Vipassana means seeing things as they are. The idea being that there's something already out there, things as they are, and they're covered over with our preconceived notions, our mental fabrications. What we've got to do is to clear those fabrications away, and that will leave just the pristine things as they are. But that's not the how insight works. That understanding actually gets in the way of insight arising because the things as they are. He said, things as they've come to be, how they come into being, that's the process of fabrication. It's not the case that fabrication lies on top of the pristine things as they are. Fabrication is how these things have come into being in the first place. This is a subtle point. Do you get it? Do you get it? This is important. Because we have to acknowledge in our process of studying our own mental fabrication that fabrication is how, or mental imputation, you could say, kalpa, how the world as we know it exists and how we relate to the world. The Buddha did not ask us to see things. He didn't ask us to see things as they are. He asked, as he was asking his disciples, this was a practice, how things have come to be thus, how they've come to be this, how they've come into being, how they've arisen, why they arise, what's the cause of their arising. So again, we're encouraged to see what is the source of this arising? What is the source of this fabrication? And the other aspect of Bodhidharma is this unbinding. So this opportunity, you could say, to be relieved from this fabrication process itself and to see things as they are, to see things without your mental imputations, see things, to see, to just see, to see the flower, see the tree, without a story, and particularly without your story, to see it, you could say, purely, and to see your own mind purely. So that's, you could say, that is the practice of Vipassana, the other wing of meditation. We stop, and then we have this opportunity to see. And they both go together. They always go together. So with Vipassana is Shamatha. Because only with settling, only with being still, being present, being kind of arriving, being one-pointed, can we see. I has seen, you could say, seen itself, precise seeing in itself, pacifies, settles, or arrives in and of itself. Okay. Another way of seeing is, you could say, of seeing is not that you're seeing something, or you're seeing you could say the process of this unbinding, of this releasing from this fabrication. This scene is basically seen after fabrication, after this mental imputation has been softened or at least become transparent. Then you could say what you see is whatever's left, whatever remains. And what remains? Well, we could say the world. You could say, or in Zen, we say my original self, my authentic self, my unfabricated self. But maybe even that's too rich to say that. Just if you drop this fabrication, if you soften this fabrication, if there's a gap in this fabrication, what you can see is whatever's left, whatever remains, whatever's there after things have dropped away. And I would say to you that that will always be enough. In fact, that'll be perfect. You know? It's not like we have to get any candy or any special treats or any special state. We're here to be real, to see the world as it is, to become real. Yeah. So before I close, coming back to this kind of a confirmation of what I just said, coming back to this case. Remember, a monk asked Fayan, I hear in the teachings there is a saying, from a non-abiding basis. Are established all things. What is that non-abiding basis? And Fayan answers, form arises even before substantiation. It's everything is right here, even before our fabrication of it. Names arise from before naming. Even before our grasping or holding or labeling onto things, the identity or the differentiation of things is already there. It's in other words, it's like it's waiting for us to meet it. A commentary on this said, teacher on from the Diamond Cutter Sutra said, he's quoting the Diamond Cutter Sutra. He's saying, you should enliven the mind without dwelling on anything. That's the quote from the scripture. And the commentary is, not dwelling on anything means not dwelling on form, not dwelling on sound, not dwelling on delusion, not dwelling on enlightenment, not dwelling on essence, not dwelling on function. Enlivening the mind means manifesting one mind in all places. If you enliven the mind dwelling on good, goodness appears. If you enliven the mind dwelling on evil, evil appears. In both cases, the basic mind is concealed. If it doesn't dwell on anything anywhere, the whole world is one mind. I love this. This is great stuff. So maybe I can close with the verse from this case, a little poem usually accompanies these cases. Let's see. This poem has I'm not sure if this is familiar to everyone. Samantabhadra. Samantabhadra. Do you know Samantabhadra? Samantabhadra is personified as a bodhisattva of kind of infinite good. We can just describe Samantabhadra here as kind of limitless good. And the other term is Maitreya. And Maitreya, although also potential person, could be understood as a potential Buddhahood, or you might even say expectant Buddhahood, expectant realization. So here's the little poem, and it's quite nice one. Without tracks, no news. The white clouds are rootless. What color is the pure breeze? Spreading the canopy of the sky, mindless. Holding the carriage of the earth, powerful. Illumining the profound source of a thousand ages, making patterns for 10,000 forms. Meetings for enlightenment in the atoms of all lands, in each place is Samantabhadra. The door of the tower opens, everywhere is Maitreya.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.